Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, fair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Dulles, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Madawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, Amarillo, I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bear, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, Canada, Monterey, Faraday, Santa.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice radio show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice radio show. I am Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us online one more time. Welcome, everyone. This is Keith Haley. I'm your host for the Jumbo Justice radio show. And we want to thank Johnny Cash, as always, for roaming the country for us and providing that great number. And again, I put forth the challenge to anybody to remember the words to that song without reading a script. It's got more than 90 cities and states actually in the lyrics. Emily and Mike, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. Emily will be hearing from you a little bit later in the show. And Mike, thank you for helping us with some of the technical aspects and getting set up tonight for the show. Wanted to make an opening comment about the guest last week. I just thought it was so interesting a show and such a heartwarming story, but yet a tragedy of, when Judy Lehman and William Barnhill was on. Mr. Barnhill, of course, had his son murdered back in the month of September by a number of illegal immigrants, and the number one suspect in the crime is still out on the loose. So you can go to citizensforlegalcommunities.org and you can get the name of that person and a picture, actually. So if you see that character, we certainly want to be calling the police or the sheriff. But it's amazing to see how those folks have recovered from that particular tragic event. And the four of the people involved will be tried in May for a conspiracy to commit murder in Warren County. And I'm going to try to get down for some of that show and actually, I mean, for some of that trial and actually take some notes and maybe do some writing about that. But a very interesting idea that they come up with in terms of trying to lobby these local city councils and county commissions to actually pass ordinances and laws that would forbid employing illegal immigrants and for illegal immigrants to be living inside of particular communities. We wish them luck with that, as we do all the other communities across the United States that are trying to do the same thing. It's probably the most serious issue of our day, and far too many cases, just like what happened to the Barnhills, have occurred all over the United States. And, of course, you can get murdered, and it doesn't have to be an illegal immigrant, but there's far too many of these cases that have occurred. Well, anyway, the purpose of our show tonight is, that, as it always is, to discuss the news and issues and events and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice, and of course that includes the juvenile justice field also. Our show is dedicated to those police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the world, and particularly here in the United States. I was talking to some folks today about overseas deployment of United States police officers, and of course federal agencies do that on a regular basis. You could work in some of these federal agencies as many as 50 or 60 different countries, but as the world shrinks, so to speak, we have lots of local police that are serving overseas now also. So it's an interesting world that we live in indeed. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio, and it continues to grow and expand and get better as we go. If you go to blogtalkradio.com and look through that list of sites and the genre radio shows, you're going to literally see hundreds of shows, and you're going to recognize the names of celebrities and entertainers and writers and all sorts of people that have radio shows now. And this is the genius of Alan Levy. He's the CEO of Blog Talk Radio. He came out of the telecom business, or perhaps still works in it, and started months ago with a handful of shows, and now they're literally up into hundreds and hundreds of shows. And here's what's actually possible for somebody that would be interested in doing this themselves. Any person, any interest group, cigars to astronomy, darts to homicide, can have their own show broadcasting live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And it's absolutely free. And sometimes I'm surprised at the organizations that haven't taken these folks up on the offer, because they could have their own radio show. And even colleges and universities years ago used to struggle to keep a little weak-powered station going. And now you can do it right from your computer. And you know what else? You can broadcast right from your telephone or a cell phone, as I did last week in Seattle. I used a cell phone and broadcast right out of my hotel window, and the sound streaming audio goes all over the world. And the shows are immediately archived, so immediately when you're finished, you in about 5 minutes, not exactly immediately, you can go to the archive and either hear that show again, and it stays up there. They archive the last 5 shows for any particular show. And you also can download it to an MP3 or your computer hard drive and play it as you wish and as often as you like. And if you don't like some of the shows you see on there, you have hundreds to choose from on Blog Talk Radio. You don't like this one, you've heard me say it before, just like on the back of the Cheez-Its box, get your own show. You can do it. Let me tell you about some future shows coming up that I think are going to be truly exciting, and I'm not overworking the word. Next week, April 5th, we're going to have J.C. Schwangruber, and he's the chairman of the Ohio First, America First Party of Ohio, America First Party of Ohio. And this party is a relatively new party, and what they're doing is sort of taking care of some things that we think that the major two political parties are not doing. And he's going to be talking on the issue of illegal immigration and crime and criminal justice issues in the state of Ohio, and some of the things that the America First Party would like to see done in the future. So that should be a very interesting show. In fact, he was a caller on last week's show, and he knows the Barnhills and Judy Lehman from Citizens for Legal Community. So that should be very interesting. And then on April 12th, we're very pleased to have a special guest with us, and that will be Gino Natalucci Persichetti, and he's a criminal justice and juvenile justice consultant to many places. He's an adjunct professor at universities, and he's the former long-term director of the Ohio Department of Youth Services. And, of course, what we're going to be talking about not only is juvenile justice, which he essentially wrote the book on, but some other issues in the adult criminal justice field also. So that should be a very exciting show, both of these two coming up, one on April 5. That'll be the America First Party of Ohio with J.C. Schwangruber. And then Gino Natalucci Persichetti, he'll be on April 12 talking about juvenile justice and adult justice issues. Tonight, the show will be as usual. We'll break it up into some commentary in the news, and comment on some of the things going on in the news now, and certainly there are loads of criminal justice issues virtually every day in the newspaper, and we can get access to those through the Internet now, which is just incredible. We have your listener call-ins, and you can call in to the show, 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. So if you've got some news item or some issue that fits somewhere in that vast field of criminal and juvenile justice, you can give us a call and talk about that. I've been promising, or I guess threatening, to do this for the last two or three weeks, and what I perceive to be more interesting guests have come up. And but tonight I'm going to be presenting my research and the research of Professor Theodora Henna from the University of Bucharest, and that's going to be entitled Private Security in Eastern Europe, Romania, Case Study. And I'll tell you more about that study. It's a long paper. I presented it in Seattle a couple of weeks ago at the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences meeting, and that's some kind of meeting. There are literally more than 1,000 papers and presentations made out there on every subject imaginable. So if you're listening tonight and you work in the criminal justice field and you've never gotten involved with the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences, I would highly recommend it. And go take a look at the course website, I mean the website for ACJS, and it's www.acjs.org, www.acjs.org, and then look on the program schedule there for Seattle. It's broken up into 4 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and you'll see paper topics there on literally everything imaginable in the field of criminal justice. Of course, if you go to this conference, you can't go to everything. You can't do that. So part of the really tough job about being there at the conference when you're not presenting and talking to folks that you haven't seen for a year is picking which panel presentations and papers you want to go hear and get copies of. And as you look on there, if you see papers that you'd be interested in, virtually all of these faculty and practitioners would be willing to send you something, and it lists their affiliation, so it wouldn't be hard for you to find their email through using the Internet. So I'd highly recommend you do that. Well, here's what you do as a listener or caller tonight. You listen on your computer with Windows Media Player, if you choose to do that, or you can call in by phone, by cell phone or landline, or you happen to be a Skype customer, you can do that. Skype's a very interesting service. If you haven't been involved in that over the last several years, they finally started charging for calls in the United States, and it cost you, I think, cost me a whopping figure of something like $14.95 for a year, where I can call from my computer to any phone number in the United States or Canada. They have other deals too, where you can actually get yourself a computer number where people can call you. And somebody says, well, in the world of cell phone, why would you want to do that? And one of the nice things about it, you kind of work at your computer and talk to somebody on the phone at the same time, and you're only on one piece of equipment. So that number, again, to call in is 347-996-5983. And what happens, I can hold on my switchboard here 5 calls at a time. And that means that 5 of us can be online, hear the whole show on the phone, and also we can all talk to each other. And those of you who've listened in the past, wherever you are, you know, and you've called in, you know that we're able to do that. So we hope you will call in if you have something to do. Oh, Audrey, you're going to do one more of these jokes. Audrey, I must point out, Audrey is a blonde, and she has become infatuated with these blonde jokes, and of course the Internet's loaded with about 14 million of them. I don't even know how she picks one, but she insists that she wants to tell us one of these blonde jokes tonight, so I've said that I'll let her do it. So let's go ahead, and Audrey, let's see what you've got.
The blonde quickly went out to her mailbox, looked in it, closed the door of the box, and went back in the house. A few minutes later, she repeated this process by checking her mail again. She did this 5 more times, and her neighbor that was watching her commented, "You must be expecting a very important letter today, the way you keep looking into that mailbox." The blonde answered, "No, I am working on my computer, and it keeps telling me But I have mail.
Okay, Audrey, that's not the worst joke I've ever heard. It may not be the best, but I'm glad that you got that one out. And we look forward to your jokes in the future, for sure. Let me look at some of the news here tonight in criminal justice. And I don't know if I'm going to make this a regular or not, but, you know, we have a lot of, can I just say it, dumb criminals. And so last week we talked about a burglar who dropped his state correction system ID card at the scene of a burglary, and when the police came to investigate that one, they picked up his ID card, and while he was sitting around at home counting the money, they showed up and arrested him for a burglary. Well, here's another one that comes out of Germany, and this is a burglar that has learned that you can take a credit card and stick it inside the lock of, like, an apartment door and jimmy that around a little bit, and sometimes you can pop that door open. Well, he actually did that. He stuck his credit card in the door lock. He got the door open. He went inside and pulled out his burglary, but unfortunately he broke his credit card in half. So he took off and he gets home, and again, he's counting the change that he stole in this burglary. And, of course, the police come to the scene and they pick up the other half of his credit card that has his name, address, all of his ID information on it. And they come and arrest him. So, you know, burglars aren't that smart. Could you stand a story from the past going back in the Ice Age when I was a police officer? I enjoyed investigating burglaries, actually. A lot of cops sort of roll up, take the report, walk around a little bit, don't like to get involved in picking up and tagging glass and a lot of other sort of things. But anyway, I had a burglary of a carryout, usual kind of thing. The owner comes in at 5:30 or 6 o'clock in the morning, he's set up business. And what had happened, this is a little tiny place. It was a former filling station, and it's set catty-cornered on a corner. And so the burglar came in through the front door, and he came in the hard way. He must have been drunk because he busted out the glass, and when he walked in, he cut his head on the top part of the glass in the door. It was a full glass door. And so when I walked in, I saw a little bit of blood on the glass, broken glass at the top of the door. So anyway, I go in and look at the whiskey bottles and talk to the owner about how much was taken and all that business. And something kept bothering me. It was hanging out or lying over in the corner. And I looked at it. It looked like a ball of fuzz. I didn't know what it was. So anyway, I didn't pay much attention to it. And I kept walking around and looking and talking to the owner. And we're getting ready to take off. And I look over in the corner, and it didn't bother me, so I finally went over there, and I looked at that, and I picked it up. And you know what it was? It was a great big, about a 1.5-inch by 1.75-inch square patch of skin with hair on it. And it was the actual skin and hair that this burglar had lost when he came in the door. So people used to laugh at me about this weird stuff. I actually tagged that as evidence. I put it in a little envelope, whatever we did in those days, and forgot all about it. And it wasn't about 3 or 4 days later where the detectives called me up and said that they were talking to I was a Dayton, Ohio police officer, that they were talking to detectives in Cincinnati, and that they had arrested somebody at the bus station that they had a burglary warrant for. And he had this, and they had been talking earlier about this burglary where kind of making a joke about it. If you see a guy that's missing part of his head, let us know. And they actually picked this guy up in Cincinnati, and he was a guy that committed the burglary in Dayton, and he confessed to it. Odd kind of idea, isn't it? Here's a follow-up on a story. You know, way back, several months ago, we've had people from the Ohio Minuteman Project on our radio show. And most of you who listen regularly know that I've done a study of the Minutemen and down on the border, and went down there and spent some time and went out on observations with them and that type of thing. And do you recall when the Minutemen came to Columbia University here not too long ago to speak? And that great bastion of free speech, the students came in and actually stopped the presentation. In fact, they charged the stage. They stormed the stage and stopped Jim Gilchrist and others from actually making a presentation. And then Mayor Bloomberg in New York, as a matter of fact, he made some strong comments about that. He says, you know, that should have never happened, and Columbia should do something about that. Well, the president promised right after that that he was going to do something serious. Well, here's what happened. They finally did something serious to the students involved in stopping this presentation. Eight students, quote unquote, this is in the Chronicle of Higher Education, were given a slap on the wrist this week for storming the stage during a presentation last fall by a speaker for the Minuteman Project, a controversial group that vehemently opposes illegal immigration. That may be a little too strong, having talked to numerous Minutemen. The resulting scuffle was filmed and broadcast on the Internet and was, you know, showed up on YouTube and Google and all sorts of places. But here's what they did. The university censored at least three students, according to the Columbia Spectator, the student newspaper, while others were issued lighter disciplinary warnings. And these reprimands, both categories, will be scrubbed from the students' records when they graduated, or when they graduate. Those who were censored will face automatic suspension if they violate other university regulations. So isn't that interesting? I view the fact that I got the lightest punishment possible, says one of the students, as a small victory. And his comments were reported in the New York Times. So free speech. It should be on a university campus if we find it anywhere in America, but apparently at Columbia there are some qualifications about that. Let me go here and take a look at another thing about illegal immigration. This came out in the press this past week. It's dated Monday, March 26th in the Washington Post. It says teams assigned to make sure foreigners ordered out of the United States actually have a backlog of more than 600,000 cases, and they can't accurately account for the fugitives' whereabouts. Isn't that interesting? This is a report by the Homeland Security Department's Inspector General found that the effectiveness of teams assigned to find the fugitives was hampered by a number of things. Insufficient detention space, I would have guessed that, limitations of immigration database, and inadequate working space. Even though they spent more than $204 million that was allocated for these 52 fugitive operations since 2003, a backlog of 623,292 cases existed as of August of 2006. Isn't that incredible? And, of course, we make another estimate up here of how many illegal immigrants are in the United States, and says here it's anywhere from 11.5 million to 12 million. Those are the figures that you usually see is about 12 million. Some say it may be 15 or 16 million. Some even make a higher estimate than that. But it's certainly the issue of our time, and there's more bills now in Congress, and we'll have to see what comes out of that. But I'm not expecting a lot, at least right away. Right. Those of you interested in policing and, you know, policing turns to various styles and genres over the years, we've got beat sector policing and community policing and team policing and all sorts of things. Well, England is coming up with a new idea, and I don't know if you've heard of this, but this is a new special kind of policing that they're going to be doing over there, and it's called inoffensive policing tactics. This is an article out of North Shore News, the voice of North and West Vancouver, British Columbia. Can I read you just a little of this and see if you buy into this new style of policing? It may be the thing. In Derbyshire, England, they've come up with radical ways to combat crime after the force's chief constable refused to release the photos of two escaped murderers, claiming it might breach their human rights. That's right. Derbyshire isn't alone in England in terms of its dedication to the rights of lawbreakers. The Suffolk police recently warned local citizens against the impending discharge of three drug-addicted lifelong criminals. All three were expected to reoffend. The police nevertheless withheld their names, their photographs, and their ages for fear of intruding on their privacy. Now, Derbyshire Force has taken this one step forward, and they plan to lead the world and what they call inoffensive policing tactics, IPT, IPT. Yours truly was the first on the scene, meaning the reporter, to record what sure is to be groundbreaking news. announced during a cream tea over quiet chamber music performed by an accomplished quartet of career shoplifters. Spokesperson Jeremy Calhoun unveiled the new program, first on the Derbyshire Police Force agenda. He says we'll be recruiting blind detectives. He says there's no reason in this day and age for crimes to be solved using visual clues, which are pejorative. Calhoun told a small group of mostly English journalists who nodded their approval. How does the appearance of a suspect tell us anything about whether he was responsible for a particular transgression? Maybe they got a point there. Blind detectives will use hunches, funny feelings, and their spidey sense to track down suspects in crimes, Calhoun explained. If successful, detectives will ask the alleged criminals to drive them back to the station, as blind residents of Derbyshire cannot yet legally drive. When they arrive at the quaint stone cottage headquarters of the station, they'll have a nice cup of tea and a chat. The police will formally make the arrest. They're even suggesting maybe licorice strings will be used to lash wrists together in lieu of handcuffs, as some English criminals are actually allergic to non-precious metals. Kind of interesting, isn't it? It goes on and on, some of the things they're planning on doing. They're going to take dogs out of the business, too, because they think the dog's scent is too strong and they're prejudiced by scent. And they may smell blood on somebody's hands or clothes or something like that, but, you know, that doesn't mean anything. They could have cut themselves mowing the lawn or sewing up clothes or something like that. So it'll be interesting to see what they're doing. And instead of issuing warrants, they now plan on putting ads in the paper, like full-page ads, and having a friendly advertisement asking the people, the criminals, to turn themselves in. Here's one that might work. We'll begin with a friendly hello, they said, then ask, for instance, did you perchance get overcome with jealous rage on a Thursday night and take a machete or some sharpened scythe to your ex, a footballer, a barmaid sweetie, or what? If so, drop by for a word. Don't waste time and energy stewing in your bilious juices. We have ways for you to work off your debt to society. So I don't know if we're actually going to do this kind of policing. What do you think? I'd be interested in your comments. I have one more case I think I'll save there, a news story I'll save to next week. And it's about the state of Georgia now, at least its public defender system, is bankrupt. They have spent the case has cost the public defender system, one murderer who's actually confessed. He's killed a judge, a court reporter, and two other people before he was recaptured. And they spent $1.4 million defending him, and the public defense system is now bankrupt. And, of course, what this triggers in the legislature is people, introducing bills to say that we can't afford the death penalty anymore, so we should get that famous sentence called life in prison without parole. I hope you're not one to ever believe that one. Here's an issue in Colorado where they've spent $40 million in three decades just to execute one inmate and to put two others on death row. Can you believe that? $40 million. There's some other details of it, but I think it's an incredible kind of thing that they're dealing with. I mean, we want everybody to get their rights, but, I don't know if you get the dream team every time. Maybe you should, but I don't think American can actually afford that. Well, let's talk private security in Romania. This is sort of a case study. I did this study with Professor Teodor Enna from the University of Bucharest. Let me set a little background for this. Professor Enna was the project coordinator on the Romanian side for our USAID team. We had a research grant with a number of people. Our team consisted of 8 or 9 people. And we went over several times over four or five years to assist the Romanians in democratizing their criminal justice system. And part of that part of the project was to assist them in setting up a degree program in community justice administration, a graduate degree program at the University of Bucharest. And it's been a wonderful experience. We've met lots of people from all ranks and levels of the Romanian justice system and police and courts and corrections. And many of us, or most of us, have remained, kept ties with people over there. And I've been over there probably, I guess, 19 or 20 times. Several of us, Dr. Jack Collins and Professor Anna and I, actually wrote a paper a couple of years ago where we analyzed the websites of the 10 largest private security companies in the United States, and the same thing for the 10 largest Romanian private security companies. So what we did is present that paper, and then we thought it would be a nice follow-up to do another study. So having done that and having talked a little bit to some of the people over there before, Professor Anna and I decided that what we'd like to do is maybe do some in-depth interviews with some of these private security executives. The private security really didn't get kicking in Romania until probably 1999 or the year 2000. And one of the people that I'd heard about over there was a guy who had retired out of the government service, retired early as a matter of fact, and took a lot of his own personal investment, his retirement, and took just about all of it and invested in starting a private security company. And at 4 or 5 years later, probably maybe 6 years later, this is a multi-million dollar operation, and I think he, in fact, is a millionaire. He's one of the three people that we did the in-depth interview with. We did structured interviews with about with three private security executives over there. Two of them were owners and operators or directors of companies, and the other was the president of the Romanian Association of Private Security Companies, who's been a real pioneer in fighting to get Romanian private security law up to snuff and also to improve the professionalism of these private security agencies. Let me mention something right off before I get into the paper. In Romania, private security agencies are allowed to do a lot of things based on their qualifications and the government's approval. They're under supervision of the police. And if you can, in fact, show that you can do patrol services, you can do disaster relief type of services, you can transport money. On any given day, almost three-quarters of the nation's wealth is in the hands of private security companies being transferred in and about and guarded by these private companies throughout the nation. Isn't that interesting that actually goes on? So private security has really grown everywhere. Of course, in the United States, we have now more than private security by personnel numbers are actually larger than public policing in the United States. We have more than a million people that work in private security. And I'll skip over some things here in the introduction of the paper, but the largest private security company in the United States and indeed the world is Securitas. And are you ready for this? They're headquartered in Chicago, Illinois. They employ about 200,000 employees. And 2 years ago, their annual revenue was $2.7 billion. So the top 10 companies in the United States employ from 200,000 down to 4,300 people. And I do know that Securitas employs just in Columbus, Ohio, about 1,100 people. Well, private security got kicking in Romania. And what we did is identified what the 10 largest private security companies were there. The largest one was Group 4, Falsica Valahia, and they employ something like 2,500 employees. They're headquartered in Bucharest, and their annual revenues 2 years ago was $5,723,000. The smallest company was Bronek Protection, and it employed about 510 people, and the revenue was about $370,000. So what we decided to do was take a look at private security in depth, and some changes have taken place in Romania. Most of you realize they had a brutal dictator, and he was tried and executed along with his wife on Christmas Day, December 25th, 1989. I'm going to ask Audrey to tell you a little bit about some of these changes in Romania, and then I'll comment a little more in depth about the paper.
I will be glad to comment on some of the changes in Romania. I do hope that we will be able to broadcast the Jumbo Justice radio show from Bucharest. That indeed would be exciting. Emily, and I could also pick a new dress or two. Anyway, here is the information you requested. A number of things make Romania unique among its Southeast European neighbors, and in general one. Romania is the only non-Catholic Latin nation in the world. 2. Romania is the only Eastern Bloc nation that had a bloody revolution to overthrow communism. They tried and executed their dictator and his wife on Christmas Day in 1989. 3. Romania is the only former communist nation that was debt-free on the day that communism fell. 4. Romania was the only communist nation during the Cold War that had most favored trade nation status with the United States. 5. Romania was the only Eastern Bloc nation that managed to keep Soviet troops off its soil for most of the period of the Cold War. 6. Romania's people have a very high regard for America, with 64% having a fine opinion of the U.S., second only to Albania. Press Review, October 17, 2006. One of the most admired Americans in Romania is Microsoft's Bill Gates. He was just awarded Romania's highest national honor, the Star of Romania, at the grand opening of a new Microsoft Technology Center in Bucharest. Gates gets about 75% of his new programmers from Microsoft each year from Romania. As of January 1, 2007, Romania is one of the 29 nations which comprise the European Union, a move that will allow it to receive millions of dollars in development funds from the EU and to compete in more EU nations' markets on an equitable basis. Investments and business are already booming in Romania, but it still has some work to do in rooting out government corruption, and the remaining vestiges of power still held by those who were favored and profited under communism.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. I think what I'm going to do for the sake of time here is kind of jump to the interviews, and we have an interesting session in the paper here on how Bucharest has changed over the last 5 or 6 years, and those of us that were on the team are actually amazed by this. And I was going to have Emily read the purpose of our study and some of the methodology, but essentially what we were trying to do is describe the rapid growth over there and also do these three structured in-depth interviews with the owners of two of the largest private security firms in Romania and then the president of that national security organization. I'm going to start with Nicu Ștefan, Mr. Nicu Ștefan. We interviewed him on June 26, 2006, and he's the general manager of a company called PrimaGuard Security Group, and he's the vice president of the Association of Private Security Companies in Romania. That's called Patronatul Societatea de Securitate, if you want that Romanian. We entered his suite in the morning, and he was a very gracious host. He had an impressive background. He worked in the he was a graduate of the Romanian Military Academy and the Romanian Police Academy at the University of Bucharest. He spent 30 years in the Romanian military from 1990 to 97. Then he worked in the Secret Service for a while there. And he was 44 years old when he left that in 1997. So he spent a considerable amount of time explaining how the Secret Service didn't really work for him. And one of the guys that motivated him to leave the government service was a member of the French, or was a captain in the French Secret Service. And he was telling him that with the talent that Mr. Ștefan had, that Romanians were not really paying him what he was worth. So what he finally did is take his retirement, and here's the thing that triggered him to get into the private security business on his own. He had a six-year-old son who would continually asking for things as kid was due, you know, for toys, you know, my friend has this and I have that. And he was remiss to tell his son that, you know, I have to wait for my government pension day on the 25th of each month, and we don't have to do that. I can't buy you that yet. And his son would say, well, my friend has this and that. And so finally he wondered, he said, what does your friend's father do? And he told him, he says, well, my friend's father doesn't work at all. He says, but his mother owns two donut establishments in one of the major marketplaces in Bucharest. And this, I guess this sort of caused him to think that maybe I ought to get out of this government pension business in the Secret Service and go out and start his own company. He went to work for a private security company, and he worked there for about a year. did all aspects of the job, from standard sort of guard duty to transporting monies and all sorts of things. And then he said he was ready to risk his savings and start a new business. And he started supervising and contracting with about 40 security guards. In less than 2 years, he had a company that grew to like 200 employees. And then he took on a partner, and they discussed the possibility of joining forces, and they started this Prima Guard security service. And very soon, they were making literally money hand over fist. And currently, 120 to 130 companies are members of this Association of Private Security Companies, and he's a vice president of that particular association. So I could go on and on about his case, security company, but they now work multinational. They have contracts in Hungary, Moldovan Republic, Greece, Italy, and Israel. And he's actually worked security in Olympic Games and that type of thing. But it's a fascinating story, and he's truly one of the pioneers in that field. And he says that, you know, he thoroughly enjoys this, and he looks forward to, you know, to more work and expansion of his company. We ask him who he promotes in a company that's growing so fast. Do they actually have to come from the military, the police? And he told us, you know, not necessarily. He thinks he has a pretty good eye for talent, and he gave us an example of a woman that we met while we were there. Her name was Camelia. And he said what he liked was sort of this, he didn't use this word, but sort of the spunk she had. And in their business and meeting things, she would stand up for what she believed in. And he had just promoted her to one of the executive positions shortly before we conducted these interviews. So he said its field is wide open. You don't necessarily have to come from the private security field to advance in his company. We also asked him about video surveillance technology in private security and the contract services, and he said that that's not really started in Romania. He said he thinks it's probably going to be a big business, but right now in the future, there's no such thing. Well, the next interview we did was on June 30th, 2006, and this was with Mr. Jan Popescu, and he's president of the Association of Private Security Companies in Romania, that professional association. And he had worked in Bucharest in charge of the police, and as the law got started in 1990 that allowed private businesses, there wasn't anything special that dealt with private security. So when he was director of police, he started getting the private security companies together that were coming into being. He says, once you start writing your own rules and your own regulations to show the government, that the police particularly, that you have you know, really professional organizations that could be trusted. So he was eventually promoted to the director of the Public Order Division of Bucharest Police. And upon that position, he got these private security companies together, and they started setting their own rules. Prior to that time, a lot of companies, a lot of corporations wouldn't trust them because they didn't know much about them. They didn't have any established indicators of professionalism. And Mr. Popescu actually got them to do that. Then in 1996, there was actually rules set up that governed private security companies. And what happened after Mr. Popescu retired, a bunch of the private security company executives got together and started this professional association, and they couldn't think of a better guy that was interested in promoting professionalism in private security than Mr. Popescu. So that's what he actually did. Their original membership consisted of like 50 private security companies that employed about 35,000 private security agents. Now they have 102 members. And there are actually about 900 to 950 companies that belong to the association, and they employ about 60,000 workers. And it's interesting, that is just about the size of the public police, in other words, the Romanian police throughout Romania. They have 60,000 staff members also. So he has fought real hard to make this private security in Romania professional, created these categories of qualification where you can provide different kinds of services, et cetera. And they just came up with a new law, and he's not pleased with that. I won't go over all the things that's wrong with that, but, for example, required training of all private security personnel, but it doesn't make any distinction between the operations level personnel, person actually standing guard maybe on the street or in McDonald's or something like that, and those who are executives and own the company, but they all have to go through training. I think I said 75% of the cash in the nation is in Romania's hands or private security every day. It's actually 80%, according to Mr. Popescu. So he's very interested in improving this law and continuing to work. And right now they've proposed 90 different amendments to the new law. And I think probably most of these are going to be accepted because the people that were writing the law actually don't know a whole lot about the private security field. So that very interesting gentleman, certainly a leader in the field. The last person we interviewed was a gentleman named Costin Opria. And we went to Mr. Opria's headquarters, and he's the general director of BART Guard Services, called BGS is the name that you see on signs and uniforms over there. And he's a tall, well-built private security executive in his 30s. And during the revolution in 1989, he was just a teenage boy. And the BART Guard private security company is a family business, and it's run by three brothers. One of them is Bogdan Opria. He's the president. And Mr. Opria said that the way his parents raised him and his two brothers was a factor in their eventually striking out on their own. So what they decided to do as adults, young adults in their 20s, was to go out and work at the ground level for some of these other private security companies with the intention that they would eventually come back and start their own company, which is what they did. So one of the brothers actually founded this BART Guard Services in 1993, commonly known as BGS, as a result of some rebranding, as they say in the business world. And BGS is the only private security company that offers medically ambulance services. Apparently, the other companies can under the private security law, but they don't because they can't establish that. And one of the brothers, I believe, is an MD. So I'm sure that that helped a lot. They do also have training programs that they do. They train people how to they get money from the government, and they train people on how to react to disasters and other national or regional calamities. And a charity is supported with funds from the private security company, and its purpose is to develop various social programs such as training children, students and professors on how to deal with circumstances deriving from natural disasters. That's really something interesting, isn't it? Because I'm not familiar with any private security company in the United States, and again, this is not one of my specialties for sure. But that sounded sort of odd to us at first, but it makes sense when you have a police that force that is probably not large enough to supply a lot of these services, and they don't have the equivalent of our Homeland Security Department that probably does some of this stuff now. It's logical that private security would fill that void. We asked him about video surveillance also, because you know you can't go anywhere or pick up the newspaper and look at police topics without finding cities establishing more security cameras or having a battle over who's going to monitor them and where they're going to be and that type of business. I think it's a topic that will go on forever. One of the things we want to do in the future on the show is have one of the executives from one of these video surveillance manufacturers and also have a police supervisor on that's in a city that has lots of these. And I got some ideas about that. We'll be telling you about that later. Mr. Opie said that actually for his clients, the video surveillance would be cheaper. He recognized that the effectiveness of this is certainly yet to be proven, but a lot of people think it's the best thing since sliced bread, and others say they're not so sure. Mr. Opie actually came to the United States and worked in private security for a little while in order to find out more about private security in this nation. And he worked in various capacities, including working patrol guard services in other capacities here in the U.S. But that's interesting. That's what pioneers do. They reach out and they stretch out and take some risk. And he came across the halfway around the world to do a little studying in the United States in order to improve his company. We asked him about the arming of private security agents in Romania, and he stated that the firearms were issued only to those private security agencies who were assigned to work in banks and in the transporting of high-value items and currency. Now, that's interesting. All the other private security agents are equipped with batons and pepper spray. And, of course, we had to ask him about the infamous and useful taser. And the taser hasn't caught on a lot in Romania either, so remains to be seen. The taser is either the best thing that's ever come down the pike for police officers in terms of non-deadly force type of situations and compliance situations, or it's this evil instrument that a relatively few number of people call it. Now, there have been deaths, of course, as a result of the taser, but I think in most cases, a lot of cities are saying it's cut injuries to both citizens and police officers down about 50%. So we'll have to see what happens in the future. We asked him about women working in private security, and he says there really aren't that many. Out of 700 employees, he said that they have about 10. And none have really advanced through the system. It's kind of interesting, but he said that women just, you know, at this point don't see this as a logical career for themselves. Apparently there are other places to go. Some are traditional, mothers who stay at home with children, and family is very big in Romania, of course, as it is in many nations, but the family structure there is very tight. He did mention that his company is perhaps the only company that he knew of in Romania that has never had a contract terminated for low quality of service. And I think that's quite a record over a period of, 10 or 12 years, however long they've been in existence. And I don't think many companies could probably say that. He did say that his services cost more. That there are certainly cheaper places to go get the same kind of service, but they charge a little more, and they like to provide the highest quality service they can. So looks like things are going fairly well for them in that regard. To kind of wrap up the paper, I'd say professionalization in private security is certainly underway, and they have made rapid progress. They've done in probably less than 10 years what it took the United States to do perhaps in a half century. There's big potential growth for this video surveillance. The three gentlemen that we talked to, and in fact others I talked to in Romania, were very concerned and interested in the video surveillance business. And I think the Romanians will be a little bit reluctant video surveillance issue because their former dictator had 700,000 spy files where he had their neighbors spy on them, and those files are just now being opened, and people can come and see who collected information about them and turned it into the government for the equivalent of a few dollars each month. So that may be something slow to develop in Romania, or at least slowed down because of that particular issue. And women working in the private security field, he said that all three of the gentlemen said there's no reason why they can't. It's just something that they haven't turned to, but they think in the future you're going to see more women enter the private security field. So we were very pleased to talk to Mr. Provescu, Mr. Stefan, and Mr. Opria. And these were real pioneers in the field, and you could just feel the enthusiasm radiate from all three of these gentlemen. And I guess they're also caught up in the excitement of the growth and increased revenue of their companies. But deep down, you could tell both, I think, in their eyes and their concern for the professionalism in the field that they want to provide the absolute best services for the businesses and citizens of Romania. So it was very good. We finished out this paper with a Romanian proverb. There are probably more Romanian proverbs than there are Yugoslav proverbs. And I used to say there was always a Yugoslav proverb for every circumstance in life. But this one was Ziua bună di dimineața si cununasta. You can spot a good day from an early morning. And it's indeed morning in Romania right now, only 17 years after they've broken out from under communist rule. And I think there's every reason to believe that the rest of the day is going to be prosperous in that nation and rewarding for the Romania and its people. And I would tell you, folks, if you ever have a chance to take a vacation, it's a wonderful place. Some of the kindest people in the world you ever met. They have mountains. They have oceans. They have delta. They have big cities. They have high fashion. And you women that want to go there and men want to buy some really nice clothes, Italian-made clothes, they say maybe 40% of Italy's clothes are actually made in Romania. This is the country to go to. So I would highly, highly recommend it. Now, next week, I did want to mention somebody called today about, or wrote me today about Joe Niehaus, who was on our show several weeks ago talking about forensic investigative hypnosis. And his book is on Amazon.com, and she wanted to know about his book, and she looked forward to reading that. So, Joe, if you happen to be listening tonight, we've sold you at least one book. I take no commission, actually, from that. So next week, look for our show on the America First Party. And it's going to be an interesting show to hear what this new political party is doing in terms of things that some other parties are not. So I look forward to seeing you next week. And be careful, and we'll be seeing you again.
Don't go away. Don't go.